All right, welcome to Colonial Outcasts, a podcast dedicated to exploring the functions and dynamics of empire and how they're bad for everyone, including the citizens of that empire. This week, it is surprisingly easy to do, as we are going to dive right into part two of our coverage and analysis of Israel's misguided and catastrophic assault on Rafah, which, in case you're living under a rock, is a Palestinian city in the southern Gaza Strip, where roughly 1.4 million internally displaced civilians are sheltering from the Israeli Defense Force's largely untargeted onslaught. In part one, published last night, Wednesday the 7th, we talked about the timeline leading up to the assault, how Netanyahu said that regardless of a ceasefire deal, the Rafah assault will move forward, about how Hamas accepted the deal, which was brokered through Qatar, Egypt, and the CIA, and how Israel refused. Then as the Met Gala, and if you don't know what the Met Gala is, it's this massive charity event for all the fashionistas and glitterati in North America, happened on May 6th, and Al Jazeera was banned from reporting in Israel that same day, and that's when Israel initiated a massive bombing campaign and sent tanks into the south. So they warned Palestinians to relocate at Al-Mawasi, a Bedouin town to the north, which, you know, can't accommodate 1.4 million people. And the IDF occupied and quote-unquote secured the Philadelphia Corridor, which they haven't. But the Philadelphia Corridor is the Israeli code name for a narrow strip of land 14 kilometers in length situated along the entirety of the border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. So this move is generally agreed to be in violation of the 1979 peace accords between Egypt and Israel. We'll probably move it more into that later, but we read Egypt's silence on this development to be, at the very least, tacit acceptance of the IDF's prosecution of this action on the part of the Egyptian government. Some would argue it's outright complicity, the Egyptian government not even protesting against this action. So we're going to focus on the larger strategic picture today, starting with the real and developing tension between the U.S. and Israeli establishments over the ceasefire negotiations, the withholding of bombs to Israel by the Biden administration last week, etc. So also the completion of the $320 million aid port, the ongoing complicity of the Egyptian government in the Rafah operation, their courting of the Bedouin tribes to deal with Palestinian refugees in the Sinai, the potential for U.S. private contractors to take over security of the Rafah border crossing, and whatever else falls into this sphere of complex geopolitical issues that are all centering on this Rafah operation. So in order to help us unpack this absolute catastrophic mess, we are joined today by returning geopolitical analyst Elena Xenofontos, who's in the Middle East and coming to us from Cyprus, another hotbed of Israeli strategic interests. So thanks so much for coming on again.
Glad to be here.
So I've been advised, based on our last episode about BRICS and China's Belt and Road Initiative, that we're going to have to chill and make things more digestible, because it turns out that most people aren't massive international relations and foreign policy nerds. So I think I'll play interlocutor, ask you basic questions, and give contextualizing notes on this one in this episode. So that will be the format. So this situation right now in Palestine is dynamic, complex, and fast moving. So we'll just wing it and hope for the best. And before we get into the episode proper and begin by discussing this U.S.-Israel tension that has been developing, I want to play a clip from a Biden speech during Holocaust Remembrance Day, where he says a lot of problematic things and seems to intimate the U.S.'s unconditional support for Israel, which is in contrast to some of the moves being made behind the scenes. And then we'll jump right in. So if you watched our last episode, I played this clip, but it's so irresponsible and just downright bad that I'm playing it again. So this is Biden from yesterday. Here we go.
Three. On the sacred Jewish holiday, the terrorist group Hamas unleashed the deadliest day of the Jewish people since the Holocaust.
Weaponizing the Holocaust
again. Driven by ancient desire to wipe out the Jewish people off the face of the earth.
Uh-oh.
Over 1,200 innocent people, babies, parents, grandparents, slaughtered in their kibbutz, massacred at a music festival, brutally raped, mutilated, and sexually assaulted. Thousands more carrying wounds, bullets and shrapnel from the memory of that terrible day they endured. Hundreds taken hostage, including survivors of the Shoah. Now, here we are, not 75 years later, but just 7.5 months later. And people are already forgetting. They're already forgetting that Hamas unleashed this terror. It was Hamas that brutalized Israelis. It was Hamas who took and continues to hold hostages. I have not forgotten, nor have you. And we will not forget.
Okay, so, yep.
Yeah. I'll let you say your piece, and then I'll say mine. I don't want to go on a rant or anything.
Okay, well, I'll initiate, and you can alley-oop. That's a basketball term. A rare one, because I rarely use sports terms. But anyways, so we've got, it seems like Biden is speaking directly to his Zionist cohort. He's saying all the Hezbollah talking points, the weaponization of the Holocaust, atrocity propaganda from October 7th that's been since debunked, doesn't at all mention the suffering of the Palestinians, doesn't mention that Israeli Apache attack helicopters fired on the Nova Festival, Israeli tanks fired into the kibbutz, the murdered babies, the systematic mass rape, and it's just more atrocity propaganda. And what I found interesting, not only also I wanted to mention the mobilization of Islamophobic tropes, like the ancient desire to kill Jews, which, you know, that has only ever been a European phenomena. But all that aside, it seems like the actual U.S. government is making a completely different moves behind the scenes that are in contrast with this unconditional support he's portraying publicly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, with the deal that came through, the deal, or what they call now the counter proposal by Hamas, a lot was revealed with regards to the tension between the United States and Israel. So actually, I'd like to go back a little bit and sort of start from the point of the offer, like the deal that was actually, or the proposal that was made to Hamas. When that proposal was made, it was actually drafted by Israel. And on the 29th of April, which is just, what, a week and a half ago, 10 days ago, it was actually Antony Blinken that came out and said that the deal that was made by Israel, the proposal that was made by Israel, was actually one of the most generous proposals that Israel could have given Hamas. This is the deal that we're now currently talking about. And obviously, from that point on, you got the CIA director. I mean, this is the head of the head, right? So you got William Burns. He's flying into Cairo on the 3rd of May. This was a day before the Hamas delegation were even going to come to Cairo themselves in order to discuss the Israeli proposal. And by the way, yeah, just to make this point so I don't forget, Israel had actually stated that the proposal that they offered Hamas, they had like about a week to consider it, and it would be contingent to whether they would invade Rafah or not. So if Hamas was going to accept this specific offer, they wouldn't invade Rafah. But anyway, in order to secure this deal, the United States sent William Burns on Friday, a day before Hamas even got to Cairo, in order to basically make sure this deal was going to go through. And in fact, some of the Hamas delegation representatives have even said that they spoke to William Burns themselves. And in that time period, William Burns had actually requested from Israel that they bring a delegation as well down on the weekend to discuss this proposal in hopes of actually securing the deal. William Burns then went on to meet with the mediators in Doha as well on Sunday the 5th. And by Monday the 6th, which is when Hamas also accepted this proposal anyway, a few hours prior, he landed in Jerusalem in order to speak with his Israeli counterparts. And now this is where it gets really interesting. According to a report by Axios, I don't know if you want to show that said report, but according to a report by Axios, you had senior Israeli officials that are now essentially claiming that the United States has backstabbed Israel, and that essentially the United States was fully aware of the alterations apparently made to the initial Israeli proposal, because Israel's argument is that what Hamas offered, what Hamas has done, is not accept the proposal, but make drastic changes to their initial proposal, and that they did so in cahoots with Qatar, Egypt, but also the United States. And this is really, really significant. So they're actually accusing the United States of not informing them of these details, of not informing them of these allegations, of making promises to Hamas, which we can get into in a second. And then in response to that, according again to this report by Axios, a United States official has said there were no surprises here, that the United States, or the basically the proposal accepted by Hamas, does not contain any, quote, surprises. So this directly contradicts what Israel is saying. And so in a nutshell, we're actually seeing the United States and Israel actually experiencing quite a lot of tension at the moment, and it's not reflected at all in Biden's speech.
Right. And before we kind of plumb the depths of that tension, I just want to, because we haven't spoken what the exact details are, and most media isn't reporting it. I know Al Jazeera put this out. So Gaza's cease, and this was put out by Al Jazeera on May 7th. So Gaza's ceasefire proposal, the one that is approved by Hamas. So Al Jazeera has seen a copy of the Gaza ceasefire proposal that Hamas accepted. Israel says it doesn't agree with it, but will join further talks while it continues its assault on Gaza. So this is the, at least has the skeleton of the ceasefire proposal that was active in February, March, which was a multi-stage deal that would have a phased exchange of hostages as they work towards a sustained and permanent ceasefire. So supposed to, the three stages of the deal supposed to take happen over the course of 42 days would involve stage one, temporary cessation of hostilities, the withdrawal of Israeli forces eastwards, so into the Gaza envelope, out of Gaza, presumably, unhindered entry of humanitarian aid, displaced Palestinians to return home, Israeli planes and drones to stop flying over Gaza for 10 hours a day, I'd assume at night, but who knows what the specifics are. Hamas, Hamas releases 33 captives, women, the sick, male civilian age below 19 and above 50. Then Israel releases 30 Palestinian prisoners for each civilian captive and 50 for every captive female soldier. The reconstruction in Gaza will begin during stage one. So this would be, honestly, it would probably look like just clearing rubble at this point. The logistical facilitation of getting like any building materials in is absurd at this point. So allowing at least 60,000 temporary homes and 200,000 tents into Gaza. Okay, so that's stage one. Second stage would be military operations and permanently. Israel withdraws from Gaza completely. Exchange of remaining captive Israeli men and soldiers for Palestinian prisoners. Okay, so this would be the bulk of the prisoners would at the end of stage two be returned. They'd still have a few left, just for assurances that a permanent ceasefire would take effect. And then the third stage is exchange of remains of captives and prisoners held by both sides. So exchanging bodies, remains, and then the rest of the prisoners. Then a 3 to 5 year Gaza reconstruction plan begins. Obviously, you know, BlackRock would be happy to get on that, and DynaCorp and Halliburton and whatever. And then the siege of the Gaza Strip ends completely at the end of the 42-day period. So that was the bones of the ceasefire plan, which has really been on the table for quite a while. It's had numerous iterations. And then you were saying that Anthony Blinken said, quote, it was the most favorable, most generous offer yet.
Yeah. Given by Israel. I mean, this was something that's constructed by them. And then I was reading a report by Al Monitor. This was from a week ago when they were outlining the proposal given by Israel. And it was pretty much exactly the same. I think there was only just a minor, I think the only differences were with regards to the siege and Yeah, but that's basically it. It was pretty much along the same lines. And now Israel's coming out and saying there were these drastic changes and that it's really more of a counter proposal because it's so different. But even Hamas have come out and said, listen, the basic framework is exactly the same. We might have had a couple of details here and there, but everything is actually exactly the same. And then based on the report by Axios that we're going to look into, the U.S. official that is referenced in this report said there was no surprises. So again, we're looking at Israel's own proposal that was accepted. And now they're trying to claim that it's just completely been altered and therefore is not sort of feasible.
Yeah. So referencing this Axios article, it says, behind the scenes, three Israeli officials said the Hamas announcement on Monday surprised the Israeli government and that Israel didn't receive the text of the group's response from the mediators until an hour after Hamas released its statement. Now, when the Israelis read the Hamas response, apparently they were surprised to see it contained many new elements. According to the U.S. officials, it didn't. It looked like a whole new proposal, one official said. There was a lack of coordination with Israel. A source with knowledge of the negotiations said the U.S. invited the Israelis to Cairo over the weekend, but they chose not to send a team. Another Israeli official admitted it was a mistake that led Israel to have less of visibility into the talks. It just seems like there's a lot of like confusion. There's some conflicting, quote unquote, insider knowledge. But I don't know what your read on that is.
But I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous because in the article it says that Burns, CIA director, spoke on the phone with Israeli Minister Gallant, and they're claiming that he didn't even tell him. But Burns even flew into occupied Jerusalem to speak with his counterparts in order to inform them as to the negotiations that took place over the course of the weekend. And at this point, what they're essentially saying is that William Burns and the United States officials not only failed to inform them, but that they're essentially being duplicitous, that they're lying, concealing information. This is quite significant because obviously the United States is their greatest ally and has been their biggest protector up until this point. And now they're claiming that the United States is almost in cahoots with Hamas. that's essentially what they're trying to present at this point. And I think it's very significant.
Right. Yeah. And then we have reportedly two Israeli officials said the feeling is that, quote, Israel got played, unquote, by the U.S. and the mediators who drafted a new deal and weren't transparent about it. So if we're going to like look in between the lines, Israeli officials are suspicious that the Biden administration gave guarantees to Hamas through Egyptian and Qatari mediators about its key demand that a hostage deal will lead to the end of the war. I could see how Israeli officials in the main government apparatus that's pushing for a continuation of hostilities wouldn't want a hostage exchange to lead to the end of the war, obviously.
They openly state to that. I mean, Netanyahu said, deal, no deal with the hostages. We're still going to continue our operations. Yeah. He does that. So, but the other aspect here as well is like, I don't remember if it's mentioned in this report or the Times of Israel report, is that apparently the same U.S. official, when questioned with regards to the existence of Hamas or Israel's demand to continue the operations until the elimination of Hamas, he refused to answer that. He didn't comment on that, which this also shows that there are significant different trajectories for Israel and the United States at this point. And the United States no longer, I think they fully apprehend that their self-interest no longer lies with Israel and its antiques in Gaza.
And plus, because they're also being completely unreasonable. Like we know that the ODNI, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which serves as like the nexus point between a lot of different intelligence apparatuses within the United States government, like does its own investigation and reporting and collection on Israel. And they've put out multiple reports that, you know, Hamas has only been degraded by 20% and they're actively replenishing their ranks. Yeah. You have field grade officers and general officers in the IDF coming out to Ynet saying, yeah, you know, we can't defeat Hamas before like 2026 at the earliest. And it's like, dude, that is actually really optimistic. But in spite of that, Israel has said it will not commit to ending the war as part of a hostage deal, and that once the deal is implemented, it will resume the fighting in Gaza until Hamas is defeated. And Hamas won't be defeated, and Hamas really doesn't need to make any concessions. So it just seems, in the simplest way possible, that Israel is like treading water right now. They don't have anywhere to go.
Oh, they are. And this, like you said, so we've got intelligence reports coming out of the United States, and we've got veterans from the Israeli intelligence that are saying there is no way we can defeat Hamas. Like you said, it's even optimistic until 2026 or 2027. And so at this point, the window of legitimacy is completely closed. And even Jake Sullivan came out and said, essentially, in order to try to, I guess, coerce Israel to look at different alternative means by which to, quote, defeat Hamas, he said there are other ways to defeat Hamas, that are not military, again, basically in nature. So this is the United States making it clear that they do not want a continuation of this genocide or war, because they understand it's basically being catastrophic for the United States and its own interests and its hegemony over the region.
Absolutely. And you know, they've stated that the Rafah assault will be a red line. I think Biden has made similar threats before, but they really haven't had teeth. So they went ahead with the Rafah operation. And now it seems, this is recent reporting from a few hours ago, some of the weapons shipments are going to continue to be blocked as part of this Rafah operation. Of course, Israel can't handle it being told no, so they're making a huge deal out of this. But, you know, it's not even a red line. This is not really even political pressure, but it's significant insofar as this is the first time they've actually started blocking shipments of munitions.
It is symbolic. It's the first time that they've done so. And that's the thing as well. With regards, I mean, it is a red line, right? It's not a red line as in, obviously, they've gone through with the operation, and we're still seeing the United States somewhat taking a very soft stance with Israel, for sure. But it will end up being a red line, ultimately, because if they continue the occupation or the takeover of the Rafah crossing and the catastrophic impact that that's going to have on the Palestinian people, the international peer pressure will be just too high. And even in that aspect, the United States cannot tolerate and will not tolerate the Rafah crossing being closed for an elongated period of time. It's not going to be sustainable politically for the United States. And so naturally, this is another reason why they do want to bring an end to this, because this is just not sustainable.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot of other concerns in the region. There's the Saudi-Israel normalization pact
that's gone downhill.
That's gone downhill. They're losing influence in the region to China and Russia. You know, in terms of influence.
When we discuss Egypt, we can even discuss that now with regards to Egypt as well, and why this is, again, not sustainable from even the perspective of Egypt. But like, I mean, look, the main thing that's happening here, if you even look at the ceasefire agreement that we've seen, it's so favorable. I mean, the fact that the CIA director was there to broker this deal, and it is very favorable for Hamas. It means that they still retain power in Gaza. All Israeli troops are out, and essentially they get everything that they could have possibly could have got from the scenario, the release of the, I don't know how many hundreds of Palestinian prisoners. When you consider that the CIA was involved in this, this is a massive slap in the face for Israel. And the taking over the Rafah crossing is essentially trying to put pressure on Hamas to basically try to put forward a better agreement, or to pressure Hamas into a more favorable agreement for Israel. This is aesthetic. In order to aesthetically claim victory, this is what it's all about. It's going to be temporary. It's not going to be something that I believe anyway. Obviously, you never know. That's going to go on for an elongated period of time, because it's just quite simply doesn't serve the interests of the U.S. anymore. It's not feasible. And this is just Israel being a sore loser.
Yeah, well, you know, this is right out of their playbook. I have often, for the past 7 months, bringing up their core military doctrine. And it's not just their military doctrine. It's also inherently political as well. It's the Daya doctrine, which is named after a suburb in Beirut that they bombed the hell out of during the 2006 Lebanon War. And the premise was, you know, they'd hurt the civilians so bad that the civilians would never let Hezbollah, you know, hurt Israel again, or that in the future the civilians would pressure Hezbollah into giving up political concessions to Israel. So their core doctrine is literally collective punishment of civilians. It's literally a freaking war crime. So this occupation of the Philadelphia corridor is just more of the same. They tried to weaponize hunger and the withholding of aid to get Hamas to concede. And now they rejected this Hamas proposal and they've invaded Rafah, putting pressure on 1.4 million displaced civilians in order to make Hamas concede. But Hamas won't because they don't need to.
But not exactly. They don't need to. They didn't even do it. I mean, if you think about the northern part of Gaza, it's been basically shut off. It was shut off for months. I mean, that could have even put pressure on Hamas to have accepted deals earlier on, and they didn't. Do they really think that Hamas is going to cave now when, for all intents and purposes, this war is actually coming more closely to an end? Of course they're not going to do so. This is just desperation at its finest, because ultimately, like even with the Ynet article that you referenced earlier with the former veterans of the Israeli intelligence discussing the fact that essentially, you know, we need years and if we can defeat Hamas, in the same article, they were essentially saying that not only does Hamas have basically complete control, but Israel has completely, they've ended their main military operations in Gaza. And what they're going to be doing now is like these sporadic controlled raids. So if you didn't accomplish to pressure Hamas during your main military operation, when you were starving off the northern part of Gaza completely, you're not going to achieve anything now. It's just desperation.
Yeah, it is. And it's what we talked about in part one from last night. The second Israel initiated its Rafah invasion to, quote unquote, destroy the last four battalions of Hamas. They, of course, haven't defined what a Hamas battalion is, how many people it's composed of, how they operate, or anything. But it's four. It started out at three, then it went to six. It depends on Netanyahu's mood. But as of yesterday, it was four, last four Hamas battalions. And then at the onset of the Rafah operation, Hamas fired 30 rockets from northern Gaza, showing the world that showing the world like, hey, we're still in the north. And according to that same Ynet article from like 3 weeks ago that we've been referencing, that you just referenced, according to Israeli intelligence veterans, Hamas has reoccupied Khan Yunis. So you know, there's that, all those massacres that happened, all those hospital attacks for nothing, because according to Israel's own reporting, they're in the south too. They're in the north. They're actively conducting mortar strikes with indirect fires on the Netzarim corridor. I keep mispronouncing it, but it's
Netzarim. Yeah. Corridor. Yeah, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly either, but I'm not an expert. But you're 100% right. And in that same article, it actually went on to say as well how Israel can no longer even achieve the most modest goals in this war. That is coming out of Israeli media and Israeli intelligence. This is very significant that they can't even achieve basically breaking Hamas even civilian control, not more or less their military control. And they were discussing even how Hamas has essentially put in place price controls throughout the territory so that there isn't that sort of price inflation as a result of the lack of aid, essentially. So, I mean, they've essentially failed, and it's been 7 months of brutalized genocide. And they think that by occupying Rafah right now, they're going to essentially change and coerce Hamas to succumb. Of course, it's not going to work. It's going to be a complete fail. And it's going to boomerang back onto Israel because it's going to be international pressure on Israel, because obviously now they're basically going to be conducting severe aerial bombings of a small city of 1.5 million people. That's going to be unacceptable. And I think that international pressure is going to affect the United States significantly. And Israel is not going to be able to sustain whatever their Rafah operation is for a very long time. Again, this is speculative, because you never know. But that's my belief.
Yeah, I mean, they were empowered by this aid package. That gives them, a couple more months potentially. All of these aid packages are fungible, so you're not entirely sure where all the money is going. But we assume it's kind of empowered them to take on this operation. But it's really, as you mentioned before, just a PR stunt in a way. Like, they go into Rafah, do some semi-targeted raids, maybe, then, soon they'll declare total victory and they've beaten Hamas into submission, and they'll take that propaganda. Hezbollah machine will work overtime. And that is one way they might be able to extricate themselves, but it doesn't matter because, you know, I see in your show notes, you know, this not just boomeranging back on Israel, but also on U.S. officials too. You know, U.S., you wrote that U.S. self-interest to end this current war, the ICC sanctions, as some people seem to perceive the threat of sanctions on the ICC as U.S. desire to continue the war.
Yeah, so I received, so I made, when I made a post on my social media platforms, a lot of people were asking, but what, the, I mean, when I said that essentially the United States wants this war to finish because it doesn't serve them, one of the arguments that people were using was, yeah, but they just threatened that they were going to basically sanction members of the ICC. Now, there's two things here. First of all, there hasn't even been official statements from the ICC per se, or even a mention that they're going to arrest any members of Israel. This is something that's been coming out of Israeli officials. It could be a distraction. It could be maybe inside intel. I don't know. But it hasn't even been, it sort of just came out of nowhere, and it's from Netanyahu himself. But what people need to understand is that when the United States, these sort of Senate members had made these sort of threats, it comes from a position of self-preservation. So it's not because they want the continuation of the war. First of all, it does set a dangerous precedent in general. However, what a lot of people fail to understand is the precedent has already been set when the ICC issued an arrest warrant for Putin anyway, because usually presidents and political figures who are still in power have political impunity. But That's already sort of been somewhat destroyed in a way. But the second and most important aspect is that if the ICC was to issue arrest warrants for Israeli officials, that would automatically mean that U.S. officials would also probably be who are complicit in war crimes and genocide just by the aiding and abetting of Israel could also find themselves having been issued arrest warrants by the ICC. This is why they're making these threats. Again, it comes from a position of self-preservation because unfortunately for the United States, or fortunately rather, is that they're linked at this point to Israel's actions in against the Palestinian people. So this is a matter of self-preservation. It has nothing to do with the United States wanting to the continuation of the war. At this point, the United States has lost credibility. It's destroyed its own international rules-based order. It's undermined its own United Nations institutions, which were funded and created by the United States for the purpose of establishing a legal framework by which to sort of control as part of the imperial power, let's say, of the United States. They've undermined that completely. They've turned world governments, other world governments away, like we've discussed in our performer podcast. People are now looking for alternatives, whether it's through BRICS or other mediums by which to break away from Western hegemony. So if anything, it's shot itself in the foot, quite literally. So by continuing a genocide that's got so much public, it's been so approved by the general public around the globe, including in the United States, it's basically politically destroying itself and it needs to come to an end. This is why as well we're seeing this tension with this particular proposal, counter-proposal between Israel and the United States.
Yeah, and before we move on, I just wanted to spell out the ICC thing just for a minute because you brought up how we're undermining our own rules-based order. So the International Criminal Court is the highest judicial body that prosecutes war crimes on official level, like for officials, like government officials, like the ICJ is for states, the International Criminal Court, the ICC is for people. So on a very basic level, the United States and Israel are not part of the Rome Accords. They're technically not subject to the ICC, but neither was Putin as like the Russian hegemon. But, you know, he still got slapped with one. And it's symbolically important. And, you know, it could mean that, you know, no more vacations in Rome because you might get a knock on your door at night being like, hey, the ICC wants to talk to you, man. So it does limit travel options. But, you know, there's been this wild rumor going around that they're about to get hit with arrest warrants, but the ICC has again made no official statement. And that's why a lot of people think that it's actually being generated by the Israeli government, this rumor of the ICC's imminent arrest warrants, because as Alina was saying, the actions of the Israeli officials in the Knesset Smotrich, Ben-Gvir, Yoav Gallant, Netanyahu, are tied to the American politicians who have been supporting them indiscriminately. So by creating this rumor of an ICC warrant for Israeli officials, it could, again, boomerang back on U.S. senators like Mitch McConnell, like Tom Cotton signed the letter threatening the ICC. A lot of these establishment, generally far Republican officials saying that, threatening the ICC officials that with like, you can never come to America. We will deny your visas. We will sanction your children and your employees and over something that might not even exist. So
it's also a massive distraction at the same time. Like the KFC people are now discussing this. It's everything's also, you know, it's a nice little conversation to have and very dramatic, you know, very hyperbolic. We're going to sanction your kids and families. And then people are discussing it and people are getting outraged and we're getting distracted from crimes. You guys, they're trying to distract. Yeah. Because it works, but they try.
Yeah. So I'm definitely glad we covered that. But like, I love the irony of, you know, the U.S. senators and congressmen being manipulated into undermining the own liberal institutions that, you know, the America is set up to as a global order. And so, yeah.
Yeah. But, I always tell people, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No. You go ahead. What do you always tell people?
But I was going to say, like, one small parenthesis, somebody who did law and I spent 10 years in this damn field. One thing always people have to remember is that the legal system, the legal framework, I mean, it's a facade of control, essentially. People always have to remember that when you have an a legal system, whether it's national or international, that was set up by the very individuals that it's meant to sort of control, even, you know that it's a corrupt system in itself. So law is a system, it's a framework established by the elite class in order to sustain their power. And people always have to remember that. So even when we're looking at international institutions, the ICJ, the ICC even, I mean, the very premise of them is political control. It's class control. And it's just always something that I think people should always remember.
Yeah. So we talked about Israel's goals. They want to shut down Rafah crossing in order to apply pressure on Hamas in order to accept a deal that's less favorable to them. It's not going to work. So because Israel has lost the war, they need an artificial win. So I've mentioned the basic military science behind fourth generation warfare, state versus non-state actor. I'm not going to get into that because it's beyond the scope of this conversation, but I'll just reiterate the boilerplate. If you're an occupational military force and you're fighting an insurgency, which Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the other resistance fronts in Gaza are insurgencies, so if they're fighting a counterinsurgency as the occupational force, they have to win. They have to defeat them militarily, which we've established they can't. But all the insurgents have to do when they're under occupation is just not lose. So that is another basic reason why they've lost. Israel's lost because they can't defeat Hamas. So by definition, they will lose because Hamas cannot defeat the Israeli military militarily, but they can defeat them politically. So that's what we're saying.
They've completely isolated them. They've turned them into a pariah state. Israel has lost its legitimacy completely. It's the biggest defeat that they could have given them. They've provided it to them.
Yeah. And so Egypt, part three of this episode, going on to Egypt's getting sucked into the black hole pariah statehood, too. So could you give us some bullet points on Egypt's role in complicity in this?
Yeah, I mean, look, Egypt is in a bit of a tough spot. So, I mean, if people go back as well to, okay, well, first of all, as you stated earlier on, like in your intro, Israel cannot invade Rafah without the approval. Israel cannot invade Rafah without the approval of Egypt because of the 1979 peace accord, right? So because the Philadelphia corridor is under the control of Egypt. So the fact that right now we're seeing a Rafah invasion happening from within that corridor obviously means it's been done with the blessings of the Egyptian establishment. But this is the thing. So Egypt, as we've said in one of our earlier podcasts, is very financially dependent on Western institutions, and they are in a very severe, dire economic state. It's one of the most indebted countries to the International Monetary Fund in the world. And because as well of the crisis around the Suez Canal, and even prior to that, they had a massive issue with regards to their dollar reserves. They were basically lacked. They didn't have any dollars left within their own banking system, so they weren't even able to pay back their debt. And they were in basically a very massive economic distress. And as we said earlier on, there were, I think between January and March, we saw a series of loans being given and approved to Egypt by the IMF, by the World Bank, also by the European Union. And then we saw some major investment from the UAE. And this came up to like, I don't know, something like, yeah, the UAE, our friend. I don't know. I think the total came to almost around maybe over 50 billion was probably given to Egypt. So from the Europeans' perspective, the loan was supposed to be like a migrant support loan. And so, you know, obviously, because of the ties to these institutions, because of the dependency, right, this dependency theory, but I'm not going to get into it, because they're dependent on these Western institutions because of their debt crisis, Western institutions and therefore political figures and the political elite do have an influence over the state of Egypt, and that would include Sisi. So if they told him to A-OK, allow the Israelis to use the corridor, he will accept it. However, and we can get into this, the Egypt can only do so much without basically committing political and economic suicide for itself. And when I say that, I mean it cannot, and I'm sure it won't, allow for an influx of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians into its territory. I'll elaborate as we go along.
Yeah. So one thing we have to keep in mind is, well, before we talk about, you know, the fact that Egypt has been fighting a low intensity counterinsurgency of their own with certain elements in the Sinai, I just wanted to explain, go into a little bit of detail about why the Philadelphia corridor is a flashpoint, why the Egypt is constructing this buffer zone. So just going off of the most basic definition, the Philadelphia corridor is, again, essentially the border on southern Gaza. So following Israel's disentanglement from the Gaza Strip, i.e., when they left in 2005, the Philadelphia Accord with Egypt was finally concluded and authorized Egypt to deploy 750 border guards along the route to patrol the border on Egypt's side. You know, a lot of this was because Egypt was supposed to be in charge of security. Israel was concerned about tunnels going from Egypt into Gaza, where they were smuggling arms, ammunition, construction supplies to build more tunnels, heavy equipment to facilitate that. So the joint authority, it was supposed to be controlled by the Palestinian Authority until the 2007 takeover by Hamas. The joint authority for the Rafah boarding crossing was transferred to the Palestinian Authority in Egypt for restricted passage, etc. So one of the reasons, you know, Israel is saying they're taking the Rafah boarding crossing is to choke out Hamas and find all the tunnels, but they've proven to be completely incompetent when it comes to locating tunnels. So that's one of the things that was going on. Then a hot piece of news like 2 months ago was that Egypt was constructing a buffer zone in between the Rafah border crossing, their side of the Rafah border crossing, and the Sinai Peninsula proper. So that's there was some concern that you know, that people would be stuck, Palestinians would be stuck in that buffer zone indefinitely, but please continue.
No, I was just saying they were also building, there was the rumors, and there was aired on Egyptian television stations with the 7 meter high wall, apparently they would be building within that buffer zone. And so obviously that raised a lot of alarm and concerns at the time that they were going to just basically dump a number of Palestinians that were trying to leave Rafah into that wall or whatever confinement anyway. But this is the thing, and I don't know if you want to how you want to get into it now, but So if there was an insider report that was an exclusive on Middle East Eye, and the exclusive, basically, there was some inside information that the Middle East Eye received stating that Secret Service officers asked the Bedouin tribes to assist the army in preventing a mass influx of Palestinian refugees. Apparently, the inside intel was that they're looking at a number between 50,000 Palestinians to 250,000, which I think there's absolutely no way that that would actually happen. And in this article, which I don't know if you want to explain it, but I mean, it basically states that the Arab Tribe Union, which is an allegiance of basically five Egyptian tribes, which are now, they're basically like a paramilitary that is closely aligned mm-hmm. with the Egyptian military at this point. I mean, it's very remnant of the Sudan Dagalu movement, the paramilitaries, but it's quite a powerful one, and it's run by like this multi-millionaire businessman Organi, who's strongly aligned with the Egyptian president Sisi, and they're basically working alongside the Egyptian military, this huge paramilitary, in order to supposedly provide immediate response to any Palestinians entering into Sinai as a result of the basically takeover of the Rafah crossing and the operation into Rafah. Now, this is the thing. If, and this is significant, if there's going to be such a large number, which this is why I doubt it, of Palestinians, let's just say 200,000, this would create a sort of political instability that would bring down the Egyptian government. I mean, there will be internalized civil war. We'll see something very similar to what happened in the 70s in Lebanon. You will probably see mobilization of Palestinians with native Egyptians, because we have to, the tribes and maybe even Egyptian people, because we have to remember, irrespective of the Egyptian government, the Egyptian people, the people support Palestinians. They support the Palestinian cause. They do not view Israel favorably, and they will be armed resistance. We could see basically huge civil uprisings and a whole civil war breakout if something like this was to happen. Not to mention that even all the money that was given to Egypt through all the institutions that I formerly stated would not be enough for, say, 200,000 Palestinians to be bought into Egypt. There's no way. Not to mention, we always have to remember that when we're talking about loans do not save economies. They destroy economies. It's short-term. Loans will create more debt in the future. So it's not really going to help the Egyptian economy in any way. So therefore, 200,000 or 250,000 is the maximum that they bought up in this article. 250,000 Palestinians coming in to Egypt is not sustainable politically or economically. And that's another reason why, although Egypt has, in my opinion, given Israel the okay to take over the corridor temporarily, I think forcing Palestinians out is not, and the number that we'll be looking at will be nowhere near as high, and I don't think it's going to be something that Egypt will accept, even with the loans given to them.
Right, but I mean, I can appreciate them trying to tap a paramilitary force that isn't in Egyptian uniforms to help control a potential flashpoint. Because, you know, when you have goon squads abusing refugees that the population is sympathetic to, you mentioned, for a lot of different reasons, it could be a flashpoint for civil disruption, unrest, and maybe uprisings. And, you know, that could be a flashpoint for the larger region, because we have to remember that all these Arab leaders wanted Hamas to accept the ceasefire. They want this to end too, because they're on a knife's edge with their own populations, because their own populations in Jordan, you know, Lebanon, like some of the Gulf states aren't happy either with their like leaders also being complicit in supporting within the Western power structure, a genocide against other Arabs. So there's that consideration too.
I mean, I was reading, there was a report by the Washington Institute. This was in 2022, right? So this is 2 years, and a lot has happened in 2 years. And even then, not only in Egypt, also in Saudi Arabia and Jordan, but let's just focus on Egypt now. Even then, there was a very negative view. There was So the polls that were conducted basically questioned the Egyptian population as to who they viewed more favorably in terms of Egypt's prosperity and who they would like to see more collaboration with. And the country that scored the highest was 64% was actually China. And the United States was basically losing popularity. And this was 2 years ago. Right now, with the United States complicit, in the genocide against the Palestinian people, this is probably significantly reduced, even more so. So this is significant because if the operation continues and Palestinians are indeed expelled into Egypt in large numbers, the native population in Egypt, they'll make the Arab Spring look like a walk in the park. Like it will be the end of Sisi. And through that, also the West's control over certain states in Western Asia.
Right. I have talked to some people who are more pessimistic for about the possibility of a second Arab Spring, but you know, there are some reports that governments are ratcheting down on, I don't know how, if they're even verifiable, or ratcheting down on anti-Israel speech online and stuff. But, you know, Israel has its own insurance policy because it doesn't want a second Arab Spring either. It outsources all this spyware and all this espionage equipment to all of these Arab governments that they use to spy on their own populations as well.
Of course. I mean, right now, Egypt, Jordan, people just have to remember, even when we're looking at Jordan, the king of Jordan, the monarchy, was essentially established by the British, you know, in 1921. It's a British spawn ruling of Jordan. So essentially, Jordan is still kind of a colony of the Brits and a colony of the West. And even in 1956, when you had the invasion of Egypt, it was in cahoots, you know, with Israel. So, I mean, and Jordan. So the point of the matter is the leaders, whether it's in Egypt or Jordan, they are Israeli friendly, let's just say. So any Arab Spring would completely destroy, I mean, an authentic, bona fide revolution in these states would destroy that. And I don't know, maybe I'm being optimistic here, but I actually think that this is very highly plausible, because I think the atrocity of what's happened in Palestine and in Jordan, for instance, I mean, 50% of the population is actually Palestinian. I mean, this is something that hits home for them in a whole different way. I actually believe that it's the chances of something happening internally is higher than it probably ever was.
I would agree with that. And coming back to all of this unchecked Israeli aggression boomeranging back onto the United States, a second Arab Spring would also directly compromise U.S. strategic interests in the region. And whatever comes out of the ashes of that would be probably, you could make a wild assumption and be more sympathetic to China and Russian influence as well, and yeah, Iranian influence. So potentially. Yeah.
Oh, but that's why I said earlier, like even with the Washington Institute polling, and like that was 2 years ago. And this is the thing as well with Egypt. So this is why it's interesting with Egypt. So beyond the fact that it's obviously indebted to Western institutions, it now also is an official member of BRICS Plus. Mm-hmm. It's also part of the BRI and part of their so-called Egypt vision for 2030 in terms of its economic growth and prosperity is linked and codified into basically the BRI. So it's a very significant aspect of their economic growth and prosperity that they're not about to lose. They also, I think in just the reports are from, again, the Washington Institute, that from 2017 until 2013, China, it's basically invested has increased their investment in Egypt by 317%, whereas the United States has actually reduced its investment by, I think, something like 35%. And again, the vast majority of the U.S.'s sort of involvement in Egypt is fundamentally financial capitalism, as opposed to the sort of industrial capacity that China brings into Egypt. And then obviously, they also have these bilateral agreements that were established in 2014 that are actually economic, cultural, but also security cooperation between Egypt and China. So this is the other aspect. So you're seeing a huge pull, where it's not just the Egyptian population sees China as in a very positive light. They want to align further and closer to China. And this was before all of this, and pulling away from the West. And again, Egypt is so strategically important as well because of its location, because of its resources, because of the Suez Canal. You can't lose Egypt. And it's for Egypt, beyond that, their prosperity at this point, if they're ever going to come out of the sort of indebted control, is to sustain its relationship with China. And so China itself has vested interest in making sure that the situation in Egypt is kept under control, which therefore would mean that if Palestinians were to hugely influx into Egypt and destabilize the whole country, I mean, that could cost even China, the BRI, it would completely destroy Egypt, as in its immediate future. And by the way, this would also cost the European Union, because what people also forget is that Egypt is a buffer between Africa and the EU. So much like Libya was, Egypt is the location where essentially all the refugees coming from the African continent are sort of kept at a halt so they don't enter the EU. It was the same thing with Libya. And then when Libya sort of fell after the death of Gaddafi, that's when we saw the huge refugee crisis occurring in Europe. And that's actually when the EU gave the loan to Egypt. It was called the migrant support loan. It was for that purpose, to make sure that Egypt has enough to basically keep all these refugees, all these people seeking asylum, because, you know, Western capitalism has destroyed their economies, essentially, to prevent them from entering into Europe. So Egypt is... the preservation of Egypt as it currently is important to the EU, to the West, to the United States, in order to preserve its influence in the region, but even to China and for Egypt alone, like for BRICS, for everybody. So that's another reason why I believe this Rafah operation is going to be short-lived. It doesn't serve anybody outside of Israel and their delusions.
No, I mean, yeah. And so when we brought up earlier about international pressure mounting, about like to, you know, pressure Israel to stop, you know, we've just integrated like not only Middle Eastern countries, not only Western Europe, but, you know, China, BRICS, you know, Russia, that have vested interests in not having a wider regional war and catastrophe. So hopefully that will continue to mount. Also, I just don't see how this operation is sustainable. I think in conclusion, they're going to come back after a short period of time and say, Hamas is completely defeated. We beat them into submission. And then it'll be easily debunked. And again, the Rafah crossing is also a flashpoint. I don't think we had enough time to get into how Israel commits to limit Rafah operations and grant control of the crossing with Egypt to a private U.S. firm. But we're going to be covering Rafah this whole time. And that's just a way to get to try and control the quote unquote Hamas tunnels. Oh, I mean, I'm sorry, not quote unquote. They exist and they are used for smuggling. It won't do anything. They just need to get in order to uphold a semblance of law and, you know, the fidelity of treaties, Israel out of the crossing. And if they replace it, you know, with a loophole, U.S. security contractors controlling the border crossing, it won't be such a big deal. But that's something we'll get into later. International pressure is going to mount. Egypt's in a tough position, but you know, a lot of people are rightly pissed at their government in Egypt. The tension between the United States and Israel, at least behind the scenes, very transparently, if you know how to look at it, continues to mount despite whatever Biden's protestations are at the Holocaust Remembrance Day.
It's all a PR stunt, because as well, the United States needs to show the world that they still stand with Israel, because ultimately Israel is one of its pillars in the Middle East, in the sense of before it used to be Iran and Saudi Arabia, but then they lost Iran in 1979. So they need to have Israel there. I think the United States is more concerned about the preservation of Israel as a state than Israel is itself at this point. I think they're the ones that can see more clearly, if you continue on this trajectory, you might not exist in the next decade.
I mean, that is a really good point, because every decision they seem to be making right now is in their own worst interests.
It doesn't make any sense.
like economically, militarily, politically. So we'll continue to monitor this thing as it develops, but it doesn't seem like it's going to go anywhere because there's no place it literally can go without without massive regional consequences.
I mean, even France, you had Macron, you have all these European leaders, that are basically saying Rafah's a no-go zone. I mean, this is also going to play into the United States because it's just too much. I mean, you got 1.5 million people, you're going to slaughter them. It's not sustainable. They're going to end up, even the United States is going to end up basically caving into international pressure because this is no longer the north or the center where people have somewhere to go. It's endgame. People have nowhere to go. They actually have nowhere to go. There's no excuses left. And it looks even more pathetic when Hamas is firing rockets from Khan Yunis in the north of Gaza. So clearly it's just, that's why they sent William Burns to the Middle East and he's still here trying to negotiate a truce deal. And we always remember William Burns isn't even an intelligence persona. He was his profession. He was a diplomat. I mean, he was the U.S. ambassador to Russia for many years. I mean, the man is a diplomat. It's what he does. He negotiates. He knows how to close deals, let's say. Do the deeds.
Do the stuff. Get the sweet deals. Okay. So, I've actually been talking all day. Before I go into a coughing fit, we're going to end here. Thanks so much for coming on. And this is a doozy of a situation. And thanks for helping us break it down. And
thank you for having me on.
Yeah, we might be on with another episode in a day or 2 days, depending on developments. But thank you all for listening. And we'll see you next time. This is Colonial Outcast. Cheers.